Case number 10-7013, Karen Vitel Appellant versus Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers et al. Ms. Miller for Appellant, Mr. Karen for Appellees.
Ms. Miller?
Good morning, Your Honors. I am Lynn Miller. I am presenting the case for Appellant Karen Vitel. With me today is James R. Klimaski, the co-counsel on the case. May it please the Court, this case boils down to one genuine issue of material fact, which is whether or not Ms. Vitel had refused or was willing to change to suit Mr. McCurdy, her boss's style. And as I went through all the filings that were made, including in the lower court, I found that this one question runs through all the litigation, the Alliance is saying, and actually did say in their brief to this court, the legitimate basis for terminating plaintiff was her express refusal to adjust her working style to meet her supervisor's needs. That was at their brief at page 10, at their brief at page 15. They said, here, appellees have explained that appellant was terminated because of difference in working styles that she expressly refused to accommodate. This turns into a she said, she said.
But your claim is one of intentional discrimination. What evidence was there that you presented of intentional discrimination, other than the fact that your client is in a protected class and was replaced by someone who's not? Other than that, any evidence of intentional discrimination?
Yes. Mr. McCurdy had the chance to promote Ms. Johnson, who was the HR director, to the vice president of finance. And the woman before her, the previous vice president, had groomed her for the position. When Mr. McCurdy...
You're not representing Ms. Johnson.
No, I'm not representing Ms. Johnson.
What's the evidence?
Because Mr. McCurdy did not appoint her to that position.
What does that have to do with Ms. Vitel?
Well, it shows that if you add everything up together, not just that by itself, but that he also had two other vice presidencies to fill, and he appointed again two white males. So therefore, we find...
Are you bringing a pattern or practice claim, or... I thought you were bringing a claim that she was the object of intentional discrimination.
We're not bringing a pattern and practice claim. But how else can, but that is circumstantial evidence to show that he had a bias. And then he also hires a white male to take over her place, and it is our contention that the white male had fewer qualifications than did Ms. Vitel. And we feel that these are all jury questions that have to be addressed by the jury, not just one judge. Have I answered your question, Your Honor? Okay. The factual issue is that, yes.
The factual issue, or the issue, was
yes,
that here we have someone who's the head of an organization and his executive assistant, he decides, is not sufficiently strategic, proactive, it's just not meshing. I'm paraphrasing now. Not meshing. It's not good rapport. Intangibles are not working out. Wants to replace the executive assistant. Those reasons are non-discriminatory on their face.
Right.
Right. And they would seem legitimate, as Judge Leon pointed out, for this kind of working relationship, for those to be factors to be considered. You agree with that?
Well, I would agree with that if that is what Mr. McCurdy said prior to firing Ms. Vitale.
Well, it's in his deposition.
Yes, but that's after he fired her. He
is then, that doesn't matter. It doesn't matter when you assert the legitimate non-discriminatory reason for purposes of the litigation.
I understand that. Mm-hmm. I understand
so if
that.
Those
but
are, if those are a legitimate aspect of the relationship, the working relationship here,
yes,
those were asserted.
Yes, they are.
It becomes very hard. This is the conundrum that I think your case presents, which is it becomes very hard to disprove that because those aren't objective. It's not, oh, so-and-so had a rating of 88 on the test. It's our rapport wasn't good. And how do you disprove that and get that to a jury? On the other hand, if you automatically get to a jury every time you bring a case, you know, that's going to have serious effects as well. How do you suggest we resolve what I see as a conundrum presented by that situation?
I think that one has to take into account the fact that while this was all happening, Mr. McCurdy never told through Ms. Johnson, never told Ms. Vitale that there was a lack of rapport, that she wasn't strategic enough, she didn't anticipate things enough, although all that was said to her.
That may be bad management. Is that illegal? Is that discriminatory? The fact that he wasn't more expressive and direct at the time?
Well, how can anybody change if indeed they don't know what to change?
Your point has to be that he's not believable on that, right? That was pretext, right? I mean, that's the only way that you get to a jury here is if you can show that was pretextual, right?
Well, that was pretext because
why was that?
He could name, even in deposition, he could not name any real specifics that he was upset by. No concrete examples.
Well, there were the problems on the trip to Germany.
Yes, but that problem was this, that number one, the problem with the cell phone was not due to Ms. Vitale. It was due, that was handled by an IT person.
She controverted.
Yes.
The points that
yes. And also the problem with the hotel, he said, oh, she told me to go down to the desk and straighten it out.
She controverted that.
Yes, she controverted that. And then also the problem about the trains, she stated in her deposition that she gave him a Eurorail pass.
Is your point then that for the non-pretextual reasons he identified,
yes,
she's controverted each one of those therefore
yes
to jury?
Yes, she has, because those are the only three he gave. She controverted each of them.
But didn't she admit that she was aware that he was dissatisfied with her performance? And wasn't that the point of the counseling with Ms. Johnson, which went on for 6 months, right?
Yes, she did admit that. But
she knew that he was dissatisfied.
She knew he was dissatisfied, but at the same time, she kept asking for specifics, and he had never given to her. She has never said...
But that makes him a bad boss, but that doesn't show discriminatory intent. I mean, you're not entitled to have a cooperative, communicative boss. It would be nice, but there's no law against bad bosses.
That would be the case, but I believe that can also, that taking that line of reasoning helps to hide very subtle discrimination, and that's what we're down to now. People, I mean, we had one case where, yes, this man who owned a newspaper said, I want the one right male for this position.
Well, that automatically gets you to a jury, because that's
yes,
that's direct evidence.
That's right, right.
Well, that's what's difficult, is this is an indirect
that's
evidence
right
case, and as we pointed out in Brady, the normal way you overcome the legitimate non-discriminatory explanation is by showing that similarly situated people were treated differently. That's going to be next to impossible in a working relationship like this, a one-on-one, or otherwise showing that the explanation is somehow false. And that's also going to be near impossible when the explanation is lack of proactive strategic thinking. You know, how do you disprove that, which is both a problem for both sides in this case, because I don't know how to resolve that.
Yes, but here's the problem I find with this lack of strategic thinking and those generalizations. If I were in Ms. Vitale's place, I wouldn't know what I was supposed to do to change it, because I have no idea to this day what lack of strategic thinking means in terms of what Mr. McCurdy wanted. I mean, what does it mean? That I have to be 10 steps ahead of him as to when he's going to change his travel plans? I mean, it doesn't make sense.
Right, preparing for the unknown.
Yes, that's essentially what it is.
We're reviewing summary judgment here, right?
Yes.
So isn't there you've made out your prima facie case, and so then isn't there quite a burden on the employer at summary judgment to show overwhelming, uncontroverted evidence supporting his alleged non-pretextual?
That's right, and that's the problem with what Judge Leon did. He shifted that burden over to Ms. Vitale.
Well, the burden's on you at this point, once the legitimate reason's been asserted, to overcome that. We've stated that repeatedly.
Yes, I understand
that. To undermine the legitimate in an indirect evidence case. Again, if you have direct evidence, automatically to the jury. But an indirect evidence case, and there's been a legitimate reason asserted, you have to show something to show that reason's false. The best way is to show the reason given for me wasn't given to the other person who was a different race or gender. We don't have that here.
That's right. And the question becomes, what happens when you have cases like this? Because there are...
What have you done?
We show that the only three examples that Mr. McCurdy was able to bring up...
You controverted.
We controverted those. I mean, we asked him, give us examples. And those are the only three he gave us. I mean, he was there with her for about 11 months. There had to be other examples, and yet he could not think of anything but those three. If he continued to be upset and just unhappy, well, then we should have had a long list of reasons for her.
Well, part of it was he said our styles were not working, we were not compatible. Again, it's very hard for you, I realize, to disprove that. But is that a legitimate basis to replace an executive assistant? Our styles are not working, we're not compatible.
If there's no racial bias, yes.
That's the question here. The question here is whether just saying that is enough. And if you can't disprove that, you can't...
Right.
How can you disprove it? What should that automatically go to a jury?
When you have that said with no specifications as to what you can do to change, and then you have the three examples that he gave, which we have said that there is an opposing answer for those, and when you have two people, Ms. Johnson saying, well, Ms. Vitale always said she wouldn't change, and she just walked out of my office, or she did this, and Ms. Vitale says, that never happened, I said I was willing to change. Then you have questions of fact. It becomes like a car accident case at an intersection. The red light was red, the light was green. The judge can't make that determination. It has to be the jury, and they have to look at the credibility of the people while they're on the stand. And we're also talking with...
This will mean, of course, that because this case, I think, has ramifications if we reverse here, which will mean every... case where a position like an executive assistant gets fired automatically gets to a jury if they want to bring a suit of race or gender discrimination automatically.
No, we're not saying automatically. I mean, if all we had...
I said implications or ramifications.
Okay. Well, the problem then is the other
how
side...
How would it not?
Well, the other side of that is that if you have these situations happening again, those people have no belief. That's the other side of the coin.
That's what I'm going to be asking the other side.
That's the other side of the coin. And I just, and the thing, I mean, the judge didn't even look at those three instances, those three complaints. The judge didn't look at that at all. He just sort of, the only thing he looked at was that she was replaced by a white male. And even that then becomes a jury question because we put their resumes into the appendix contrary to what the defendants say. And that would be a jury question as to who was better at the job, who was better qualified. That's a jury question.
Well, help us here. If we were to go your way, what limits could we place on it to address the question that Judge Kavanaugh raised? What would be the standard for summary judgment then for the employer? How does an employer win summary judgment on these cases?
The employer would have to provide uncontroverted evidence of all the instances that occurred that meant their styles weren't compatible. The only way you can look at things is concrete facts. Generalizations don't do anything. That's how people hide behind generalizations. When somebody tries to tell me a generalization when I'm practicing law,
it's sufficient to say, you know, you just annoy me. You're just annoying. I just don't like you. Would that be sufficient?
No. I mean,
why not?
Because racism, sexism, and other types of discrimination
hide behind that, you're saying, yeah,
can be hidden by saying that. That's a very easy out. And what is happening today is that discrimination has become more and more subtle. You very rarely find the case that we've had down in Southern Virginia where it was a good old boys system and I want that white male for this job and I won't hire this older white female. People are very smart now. They've become very sophisticated about it. And that's right now where that's the playing field we're in right now.
You're saying for even a job like an executive assistant, what's going to have to happen is to keep rating cards to really document things so that if a situation doesn't work out, that you have the paper and it's not going to be good enough just to say, we just don't get along. We just don't have a good working relationship, and this position has to be my right-hand person, and I want someone else. That's not going to be good enough.
Well, we tell our clients who come in and say, I'm being discriminated against, we ask them for the incidents that happen, for the concrete examples. And then we also tell our clients, if they come in, start making notes of everything that happens. Keep a journal, keep a log, because if you come in and just say, I feel like you discriminated against me, you're going nowhere and you're not going to take the case.
If you were counseling employers, you would tell all employers, keep a log.
I would say keep that paper trail to both sides, because that's what we deal in to find out if there is discrimination in concrete incidents.
And then you're going to encourage them to pick a fight.
No, I wouldn't do that.
That's
what's going to happen.
If you want to get rid of someone, you better pick three.
Oh, I see what you mean. I see what you mean. I was looking at it from the employee's standpoint.
Then you can say, oh, we got in three fights. That's why I fired the person.
I really think that on the stand that would appear very bogus, that a jury of six people would be able to tell.
Well, you agree, don't you? Let's imagine that somebody really is annoying to an employer, and it isn't racism or isn't sexism. They're just annoying. Should they be able to replace them? These are
no. And I will tell you that in my practice, I have come across
no.
First of all, if somebody comes in and says, I've had annoying clients, and I've had clients who I've said, I would want to get rid of this person, but the reason I'm taking their case is because they have come in with concrete examples of what happened that show bias. You know,
that's not my hypothetical. That's not my hypothetical. My hypothetical is an executive assistant is annoying to the employer, and it's not based on race. It's not based on sexism. Shouldn't the employer be able to say, I'm sorry, the nature of the work that we do, the fact that you annoy me, And maybe you annoy me for some very arbitrary and capricious reasons. The problem's with me, but you annoy me. Shouldn't they be able to change the relationship there?
Yes. Okay. Under that, we're now looking at your specific narrow case. I mean, believe me, I would get rid of somebody like that, too, if I couldn't work with them.
Well, you've said that the way for the employer to handle this is to create the paper trail. But here we have a situation where there's 6 months of counseling. I mean, he's making clear his dissatisfaction for 6 months. Isn't that the paper trail? Why is that not enough?
Because it doesn't put any concrete examples into giving to somebody so they can change. For example, when I first started out, I was a managing editor of a magazine, and the executive editor would come in and go, you know, I don't like this lead. I just don't like it. And then he used to give it back to me, I'm like, so what am I going to do? Then I got smart, and I started saying to him, well, John, what don't you like? I don't like the way this starts. I don't like the way it, and he starts giving me examples, and then I rewrite the lead just the way he wants. That's what really should have, that would have helped Ms. Vitale either say, I can adjust, or even say, no, I can't adjust.
Well, isn't that what Ms. Johnson, as Judge Brown was pointing out, isn't that what Ms. Johnson was designed to do in that six-month period?
Right, but she never gave her any concrete examples of how to change. He never said, look, he wants you to change your telephone voice. Nothing was given to her. So it was like this overall generalization, and every time she asked for something specific, she never got it. But that, again, becomes a question of fact. It becomes a question of fact between Johnson and Vitale as to what exactly happened in those counseling sessions. And we also brought up...
I think we understand your argument.
All right. Thank you very much.
May it please the Court. My name is Ari Karen, and I represent the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers and David McCurdy. To address the questions raised, I think the issue here is not necessarily the question of what do we do in the case when all we have is the executive assistant, the president, and there's this relationship issue. Because I don't think, respectfully, that that's the situation that will occur in most cases.
But what were the specific reasons Mr. McCurdy fired her? The specific reasons?
He found that she was very rigid, very methodical, and being an executive his executive assistant, he's the president of a very large trade organization where he's flying all over the world.
Is it sufficient for him to say she was rigid and methodical, or does he need to give examples of that?
I don't think you do need to give examples of that.
Does she dispute that she was rigid and methodical?
And that's just what it comes down to.
Did she?
Every,
did she say, I was not rigid and methodical?
No, she did not say that. But I will say, Your Honor, that what occurred was every time over 6 months, and this is the context, if you will, in which this all occurs, and I think it's very important because it reflects on the questions you're asking today about how do we do this in a case where we don't necessarily have specifics, is you have to look at the context. And in this case, that context is Dave McCurdy hired Ms. Vitale. When there were problems with their style...
I understand that's not quite right. The interim acting director hired her and he kept her on, right?
Well, but essentially, as Judge Lehman found correctly, Your Honor, what occurred was when he was brought on, and again, the deposition testimony of Ms. Vitale is very clear. She understood when she took the job with the interim director that she would have to effectively be rehired by the person who came in. And she met with Mr. Hurdy, she interviewed with him, and then he made the decision to have her. Part of the job when he came in, as is normally the course when you hire a president, is that you have the right to bring your own executive assistant because of the uniqueness of the relationship. And I think that's an important point here because Ms. Vitale acknowledges that well. I mean, she acknowledges that point. She's clear.
In case law, that doesn't get you that far. The fact that even if it had been a new hire, the first instance, if there's later discrimination, there's later discrimination.
True, Your Honor, but again, that's part of the context. And the entire context here is that he hires Ms. Vitale a few months later when he sees some problems in terms of their style not matching. He then gets the director of human resources, who's also an African-American female, to get involved in the counseling, and that's her job. She's director of HR.
But she wasn't his executive assistant, right? That's a much different relationship, right?
Absolutely, correct. But the point is that he got Ms. Johnson involved in coaching and counseling for 6 months. This isn't the situation that he just walked in and said.
What were the reasons Mr. McCurdy cited in his deposition for firing her? And weren't each and every one of them controverted?
Only, and this goes back to one of the problems with the case, only by Ms. Vitale's own subjective opinion, not by any extrinsic evidence. And that's really what this case comes down to. Because case after case after case has said from this court that when you're dealing, that an employee's own subjective assessment of their own performance is not evidence that can defeat summary judgment. In fact, it's not even relevant.
What were the specific examples that he gave?
There weren't many specifics because I think the issue was an overall lack of style. In other words, he needed somebody. Okay, what he really explained was he needed someone who could anticipate a problem before it ever occurred and deal with it so that he was free to deal with the larger issues and not have to be in a hotel. In other words, he didn't want to be in a hotel in Germany and have to deal with any of this. He wanted that dealt with so he could just go in his room. He didn't want to have to be in a situation to go to the front desk.
Did she claim that she had done what he had asked her to do?
Subjectively, she denied everything, but respectfully, and I would ask this question rhetorically, how many employees in an employment discrimination case are going to admit, yeah, I didn't do what he wanted me to do? I mean, that's the conundrum that you really have. And as Judge Kavanaugh, you aptly pointed in the Brady case, and if I can quote that quickly, Brady's argument would mean that every employee who was disciplined, demoted, or fired for alleged misconduct could sue for employment discrimination based on race, color, religion, sex, or national origin. And merely by denying the underlying allegation of misconduct, automatically obtain a jury trial. Brady cites no support for that proposition, which would wreak havoc on district court's orderly resolution of employment discrimination cases and improperly put employers in a damned if you do, damned if you don't posture when addressing disciplinary issues in the workplace. That is our case, because that's all we have here.
I mean, that was an unusual case, though. There was an underlying allegation of sexual harassment, and the case was it racially discriminatory to fire someone just based on an allegation that the employee had sexually harassed someone else? So that's kind of an unusual case. But the problem I have here is, how is a plaintiff ever supposed to get to a jury on a case where, an indirect evidence case, where the reason given is so subjective as to be impossible to disprove?
Because I think, Your Honor, there's going to be a context in those cases. There will be either other individuals. There will be people who notice the performance, who can come forward and say, you know what, I actually think she's...
The problem here, first of all, here, I don't think there's a huge context. I think it really does boil down to this working styles, as Mr. McCurdy said in the deposition, not proactive, not strategic. That's very hard to disprove as a plaintiff to cast doubt on to get to the jury. And at the same time, as Ms. Vitale's counsel points out correctly, that's the kind of thing you'd say when you're trying to mask racial bias, right? I mean, that's the kind of vague generality that we've seen too often over the years, that underlying that is some kind of racial discrimination. And so the idea was the jury can ferret out whether that's really racial discrimination or is an accurate assessment of what the person really thought. How do we deal with that?
I think you deal with that, and Your Honor, if I may, again, you have to, I think in this particular case with these facts, look at the situation where, again, this was not someone just came in and said, I don't like you, you're gone. I mean, there was a director of HR who opined in this. She was involved in the decision. This wasn't just Mr. McCurdy.
The counsel would say that was all just cooked up to paper the record. In fact, we had a discussion about papering the record. I think her argument as to the six-month period was he had already made the decision to fire. He was just doing this to help with any discrimination suit.
But there's no proof of that, and that's the problem with the case. It's subjective, secular, and conclusory. Respectfully, no, Your Honor. You only get to...
Reeves tells us what an employer needs to do. How do you survive what the Supreme Court tells us to look to in Reeves?
Well, because if you look also at Reeves in the context of St. Mary's versus Hicks, in St. Mary's versus Hicks, the court said in order to get past the legitimate non-discriminatory reason in order to show, make a sufficient showing of pretext. What you need to show, what the plaintiff needs to do is demonstrate, one, that the reason given was false, and that there's evidence to infer discrimination. And in addition, the other cases which this court has ruled on, and the courts in D.C. have ruled on, as well as across the country, have found that this an employee's own subjective assessment of their performance isn't sufficient to make a
judgment. Says that the record must conclusively reveal, that the reasons offered for the termination were non-discriminatory. And it says if there was abundant and uncontroverted, you need to find abundant and uncontroverted independent evidence that no discrimination had occurred. And here, at every juncture, you have controverted evidence. You claim that Mr. McCurdy was motivated by legitimate reasons, and the examples that you've given are all controverted by Ms. Vattel. So why isn't that the classic example of a jury determination? We don't weigh credibility. This comes down to a credibility determination, and we don't do that.
Well, Your Honor, if I may, the issue is that once we've articulated the legitimate non-discriminatory reason, once we've met that burden, and it is a burden of production, not persuasion, and we have done that, once that occurs, that's when that burden now shifts over. So at one point we have a burden which we've met, and then that burden shifts over to them to show as independent evidence.
To controvert it, which they've done, and now the only way you prevail on summary judgment is if in looking at those two arguments, yours is, again in the language of the Supreme Court, abundant and uncontroverted independence that no discrimination occurred. It's hard for me to see how you get that in this context.
Because, Your Honor, again, you're looking at the other cases, St. Mary's versus Hicks, for example, where they talk about exactly what the plaintiff's burden is. They're very specific in terms of what the pretext showing needs to be, and that is evidence to show two things, not only that the reason was wrong, but there's also evidence to infer discrimination. And courts have also said, again, making that point of the subjective determination from the plaintiff's perspective, that's all she has.
Infer discrimination if you can show pretext, right? If you can controvert it, if you can show that the reason Mr. McCurdy gave was not accurate.
Not according to St. Mary's versus X. I see my time has expired, if I may make a few last comments. Thank you. It comes down to, in this case, I think there is a Pandora's box that is trying to be opened. And if you allow an employee just to come in and say, no, that's not true, that's not why, and just disagree on every basis, which is what occurred, because there is an irony here. Her refusal to acknowledge the differences in style which occurred consistently and persistently over a six-month period, culminating in her telling Ms. Johnson that she wasn't going to change the way she did her job, put the employer in a position of they were going to have to live with what she said, and she does acknowledge that she made that comment. They were going to have to live with the way she was doing things and allow her to dictate the terms of that job, or they were going to have to let her go. And the question before this court is, does an employer in that context be told, I'm not going to do it the way you want to. Take it or leave it. Have the right to leave it. Thank you.
Ms. Miller,
yes.
You actually had no time left, but we'll give you 1 minute.
First, Ms. Vattel did not say that she would not change. Therefore, defense counsel saying that she did creates a genuine issue of material fact. Second, there was no subjectivity in the question of whether Ms. Vattel would not change. Yes, I understand the case law says that just based on a plaintiff's subjective analysis of their performance, that's not good enough. But we're not talking about her performance here in that context. We're talking about whether or not she refused to change, and that is an objective question. Also,
does the evidence show that they had a positive working relationship or not a positive working relationship?
Well, Again, that's a factual question, because she believed they did.
That it was positive?
Yes.
Notwithstanding the 6 months of counseling?
Yes, and I think that's up to a jury to decide whether or not she was way off base or she was okay. I mean, a judge can't make that decision. They have, the jury has to see where we stand.
Thank you, Ms.
Thank you.
The case will be submitted. I'm sorry.
May I just request site support, no argument?
Okay.
Thank you.
Setting a bad precedent.
Bad precedent.
Yeah. I was similarly situated. So my last counsel. Page 108 of the joint appendix, which is 260 of the deposition of Karen Vitale, lines 3 to 18.
All right.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The case will be